But it all happened quite quickly.
Quite quickly, and one of the things that people seem to be slow to learn is that, in fact, in Iranian politics, developments do occur extremely rapidly. There's always a tendency to try and read their origins, to discover their origins by reading back in history. But the actual developments, the formation of a new party, the sudden coming into prominence of a leader, can occur with startling suddenness in Iranian affairs. So that when I was in Tehran that first time, there wasn't any evidence that within about a year's time we should be faced with the oil nationalization crisis, which we were. I returned to oil fields after a very exciting week in Isfahan. I revisited Isfahan, but not again Tehran. I revisited Isfahan in the, during the oil crisis when rich Isfahanians, many of them descended from princes of the Qajar family, the former dynasty ruling over Iran, would half in jest, half seriously say to me, could they become British citizens, please? Could I arrange it for them? Oh, hey, the gouvernement anglais peut m'en venir, because they were so afraid of communism coming. They were all convinced, all these rich Isfahanis, in 1951, that the country was going to go communist and become yet another satellite country to the Soviet Union. And did I think I could arrange? The Ture Party was obviously something they feared very much. Some of their sons, of course, were members of it too.
It was extremely powerful, all the more so because it had become fashionable.
It became fashionable, and of course, it is Isfahan, which is the one, apart from the oil community of the south, the one major industrial city in Iran, naturally the Tude was very much in evidence. And I was constantly being told that it was all up, it was all going to be communist.
So what was the before Mossadegh came and there was question of renegotiating the agreement over oil with the British? What did the government at the time, before Mossadegh came to power, wanted out of the British? And what was the argument about? I mean, obviously the British realized that they couldn't have it scot-free as they had before, and they had to make some concessions. But what did they want?
Well, they wanted much more, much fairer concession terms, and of course the pressures were heightened after a 50-50 oil agreement was concluded between the Arabs and the United States. This set an example that the Iranians couldn't see any reason not to follow in their arrangement with the British, a more equitable arrangement, even a half and half arrangement, a 50-50 arrangement. Because the British had to point out to them that there were complications in the 50-50 agreement that was being used as an example. Of course, this meant that the host government had to pay for a great deal of the oil exploration, which is one of the more expensive items in the very expensive business of exploiting oil. And matters like that were being discussed, that of course if you want 50-50 you have to pay very much more. At the moment, as the oil company quite truthfully pointed out, all the expenses of the operation and the huge expenses of exploring, sometimes exploring in areas that proved unproductive, were of course borne by the company. If they changed the royalty paying arrangements, then of course charges and the cost of the undertaking would have to be shared in a different way too. Well, these negotiations dragged on. It's my personal opinion that the company was extremely slow to realize that times had changed and that a much more generous approach towards the Iranians, with perhaps a correspondingly less generous, less solicitous attitude towards the shareholders of the company, would have to be made. The opportunity was missed, and of course,
eventually. Were you in a position to point
this out? I was in no position to point this out at all. I was a schoolmaster, a teacher, a supervisor of language training, and absolutely no influence whatsoever.
But did you, you must have been at the time, obviously, since you had got very much attached to Persia and the Persians and the language and everything, you must have been suffering from horrible
frustration at seeing what was going on.
Yes, but not only that, but what I call divided loyalty.
Oh, very much so. Yes, very much so. Very frustrated at seeing what I thought was a rather stupidly intransigent attitude on the part of big business. and very, very, very divided loyalty. I had good friends in the oil company who used to discuss these matters with me and point out to me where my loyalties as a contractor, as a person under contract to the oil company, ought to lie. However, when eventually Mossadegh, the nationalization was put into effect and Mossadegh arranged for all the working British staff of the oil company to be formally invited to remain under the new conditions of the nationalized oil company, as he hoped that the company would continue, of course, to operate profitably and successfully as it had been doing before. There's not much point in nationalizing a company if it then goes dead on you. So he, very logically, and understandably issued a formal invitation, which was on a piece of paper, which came round to each one of us, asking us to stay. And with the extraordinary legalistic approach that was being adopted by the British, who were being extremely careful to stick to contracts and the letter of the law, presumably with legal action against the Iranian unilateral breakers of the oil agreement in the future, in mind. Members of the personnel staff actually came round to each one of us with a list of the staff to tick off as we were asked whether we would like to stay and work for the Iranians or whether we preferred to serve out our contracts with the Anglo-Iran. Each were asked, and when they got to me, of course, I said, well, I'm not sure. I said, I'm a schoolmaster, so I said, it doesn't really make very much difference to me who's sitting in the general manager's chair in Khorram Shah, whether he's a Chinaman or an Iranian or an American or a British or whatever. I said, I'm just supposed to arrange to help to teach people. It's rather like being a doctor. But they said, oh yes, but you do realize that you are under contract, don't you? And ticked me off. And so my demurring was put aside for my own benefit, of course. It was, I heard later, broadcast on the BBC News that all the expatriate staff of the Anglo-Iranian oil company in Iran, with one exception, had expressed no willingness whatsoever to consider the Iranians' invitation to work in the nationalized oil company. I was rather glad, for the sake of my parents, that the one exception was not named, because my father and mother might have been worried. As I later learned that they immediately guessed who the one exception was most likely to be. It didn't make any difference. However, we were eventually evacuated from the oil fields.
But in looking back on the events of that time, don't you find it unbelievably short-sighted and self-destructive, the way Britain behaved towards Iran, which they never, of course, repeated in any other country? I mean, you know, the embargo and the blockades and all that.
The short-sighted and self-destructive. I think there was a lot of short-sightedness before the nationalization. I mean, my favorite story, which you'll probably see on television this month or sometime, because I did tell it in the program that I was being interviewed for some time ago, the short-sightedness occurred in the lead-up to the crisis. The sort of story that I have to tell. I was responsible for providing night schools, night classes for the labor in the oil company. I had to do this in schools in Ahwaz, for example, that were partly sponsored by the company and partly sponsored by the Iranian Education Authority. In one such school, the electricity was very bad, the lighting was very bad, because the lighting in Ahwaz city was very, very weak. And so I had to light my classes with tilly lamps, which was a very difficult thing to have to do. And so I asked the government, the Iranian government, whether they couldn't improve their electricity. And they said, no, what we want is electricity from you. You've got that big oil company plant and installation here with its own electricity, which is very powerful indeed. Why don't you run wires to the school? And I therefore went to the company and said, can I please run electricity to the school where my classes take place, which I'm now having to light with oil lamps? And the company said, no, certainly not, because if we start lighting one of their schools, they will expect us to light all their schools. You see, it was this syndrome of us and them. Well, since most of the people who go to the schools are the children of workers in the oil company, and since in this instance I used the school at night for oil company financed and sponsored classes for the labor, I just can't see the point. Ah, no, we can't create a precedent. We can't supply electricity in an area where it is the responsibility of the local Iranian authorities to supply electricity. Well, now, this sort of attitude was extremely short-sighted. It would have been very much better than running into a quarrel and having a nationalization and an oil dispute with the Iranians just to provide electricity for the whole of the province of Khuzestan, which I think would have been cheaper in the end and generous, and everybody would have had a much cleaner reputation after it. But it was this kind of thing, this kind of nitpicking miserliness and caution not to give an inch more than they had to, that caused a great deal of the trouble. Once the trouble had come and nationalization had taken place, and Mossadegh's government had thereby unilaterally cancelled a two-party oil agreement into which, incidentally, arrangements for cancellation were built, which were ignored. Once that happened, then one couldn't expect the oil company to do anything else than to claim that the oil refined was its oil and that the Iranians on their own had no right to sell it. What in effect then occurred was a sort of strangling of Iran.
That's
again.
That's right. I mean, they.
A use of power such as I do not think will ever again be possible in our lifetimes anyway, a use of power by a Western power to prevent the Iranians from marketing their and producing their commodity out of their own soil.
Now this is very interesting because you see, if it were today, as I say, and Britain were to America and to other Western countries and said, you know, I'm in trouble. Could you come to my rescue by blockading trade in such and such country? The chances are that everybody would say no. But in that instance, everybody said yes. They all came out on the side of Iran. They strangled Iran. And Mossadegh in those seconds couldn't do a damn thing. And what is more, it seems to me that also within the country, the Communist Party, instead of them helping, which has since then become their policy from Moscow, their directives from Moscow, to help nationalist movements in order to later take over from them. At the time, they just opposed it. There seemed to be that there was no proper directive from Moscow. Therefore, the Iranian Tudeh Party, who were on a par with the nationalists, opposed Mossadegh until the last minute. So that Mossadegh had to really fight on all fronts. There was no way in which he could succeed, it seems to me, to win the battle.
No, the what to the communists anyway would be a bourgeois, purely nationalist revolution. or attempt on the part of Mossadegh certainly received very little support from the radical left, and eventually petered out. Of course, there were attempts for a long time at negotiation, but I don't think it was negotiation that Mossadegh was seriously intent on. Drawing to a satisfactory conclusion. I think he wanted to try to go it alone, just to see what would happen. And certainly in the hopes of far more world sympathy than he was able to get.
Well, I mean, Khomeini is going it alone, beating at left, right and center.
Yes, but the conditions have changed entirely since... Since 1951, the Middle Eastern and the oil situation are very different now.
Do you think it was thanks to the Mossadegh experience that both sides sort of learned their lessons?
Well, I don't think anybody. I think one of the lessons that was learned in the Mossadegh experience was that the world could, in fact, do without Iranian oil. But of course, that meant an enormous hyping up of oil production in Iraq. It always used to be said in Iraq that there ought to be a statue in gold in the main square of Baghdad of Mohammed Mossadegh, because he was the man to whom Iraq owed Western effort in rapidly developing their oil industry. So various other counterpoising developments occurred, so that it was possible to leave Mossadegh and to leave Iran's oil in the ground.
There was another thing.
The situation today is a much more complex affair and entirely, I think, different.
But there is another thing that also happened, which is this. That it seems to me that Mossadegh, I mean, I may be completely wrong, that Mossadegh should have enlisted the help of the Shah, at least, and to have cooperated with the Shah, because the Shah, or at least monarchy, had a very solid basis then in Iran, in the popular thing, and the Shah, obviously, himself was very liberal, wanted to do the best for the country and everything, and instead of opposing the Shah and acting as though the Shah was an adversary, Mossadegh could easily have sort of enlisted his help and backed the Shah and helped him, or asked him to help him, and would have had a much stronger hand, both internally and externally, had he done so.
Yes, I don't quite know enough about the details to know what went wrong, but of course at the beginning the Shah did cooperate quite a long way with Mossadegh. The Shah was like every other Iranian person. I've always believed that every Iranian, whether they were pro-British or anti-British or whatever they were, every single Iranian's heart beat faster when the oil nationalization bill went through. Every Iranian was excited by this ousting of this long-hosted power, this guest that had outstayed its welcome in the oil company and in the British influence in the south of Iran. Everyone, including Anglophiles, were all thrilled, actually, when it came to the crunch. And the Shah was also, of course, delighted. He was not opposed to what the Soviet was doing at the beginning. It was when the Shah began to see that Mossadegh was operating as a prime minister with the support of a parliament, a majlis, that Mossadegh was in fact operating very much within the framework of the Iranian constitution, that I think things began to go wrong. Because the one thing neither Pahlavi Shah seems to have been able to stomach was allowing the Iranian constitution, the old constitution, to operate, allowing the majlis, the parliament, and the prime minister too much power, with the prime minister responsible to parliament rather than responsible to the Shah. And of course, the rift between the Shah and Mossadegh eventually arose about over who should be commander-in-chief of the armed forces. Of course, was really a rift occasioned by the fact that Mossadegh had stolen the Shah's thunder. Mossadegh was, in fact, for a time, ruling the country. And I think that was the problem there.
So you think that he actually stuck to the constitution? You don't think that he went a little bit too far and discarded the Shah?
No, I don't think so. I think it went towards the end. He wanted to discard the Shah. Of course, that would have been unconstitutional. The constitution provides for the Shah, just as it provided for the prime minister. But I think in the earlier part, the National Front, with people like Alayar Saleh and so on, and it was very much the party of the constitution. They were very much in the line of the Mashruti Khan, the old constitutionalist, and remained so. People like Alayar Saleh, the extent Sanjavi, the other National Front people always remained really upholders of the constitution. Shapur Bakhtiar was the last prime minister who attempted to arrange things in such a way that the constitution of 1905-1906 should be eventually revived and given new life. It's that constitution, one of the major tragedies about more recent events is the imposition of a thoroughly Islamic constitution and the consequent demise of the old constitution, because I do believe that the old constitution was a very workable constitution indeed. The tragedy was that it was never given really a chance.
Never. And of course, as a result of not giving that one a chance, which was a moderate and good constitution, now we are landed for the foreseeable future
with something much worse.
Far worse. I mean, real murderers of the country. And God knows what will happen now, of course. How would one go?
Well, again, it may be that representational institutions will eventually do something to restore the balance, because one of the interesting things is, of course, it's packed with a preponderance of the religious classes at the moment, but one of the interesting things is the way the majlis, legislative assembly is coming to the fore and may be able to hold the balance in ensuring some kind of debated, properly formulated government. Not the ad hoc, capricious, arbitrary government of groups of individuals or a single charisma commanding individual, or somebody like the former Shah, a person who believes that they've got a special mission to control Iran and to rule it in their way. until such times, of course, the Shah himself was a believer in the Constitution, but the trouble was that he didn't think that the country was ready for it yet.
Well,
that yet was allowed to go on too long, and then when he did start to relax, of course, it was too late, because he simply took the lid off a box of dissidents and opportunists and oppositionists that brought a revolution about.
Whereas, but you know, if you, one looks back, one sees that the Shah, having been brought up in Switzerland and everything, was obviously naturally liberal. And between 1941 and 1953, he acted as one. I mean, he was a constitutional monarch.
Yes, he didn't have much choice, of course, between a lot of the time between 1941 and certainly between 1941 and 1946, the country, he was sharing power in the country with no less than three occupying military forces, British, Russian and the United States. But he certainly, the going back, as you've just led me back, in fact, to the that happy first visit of mine to Tehran, certainly then one felt one was living in a country of political freedom, of parliamentary freedom, of total freedom from secret police, total freedom from that terrible atmosphere of suspicion and fear that characterized lands that lack freedom. This was a Tehran where one could walk up and down the streets with whom ever one wished, of all political shades, and have political conversations as loudly as you like and anywhere you like. So that that period, 1941 to 1953, or actually I date the end of it with the rise of Mousavi. Actually, the Mousavic period, the stresses and the strains of the Mousavic period spelt the end of freedom, the beginning of policing, the beginning of the secret police, the beginning of kidnappings, of people being taken out at night and tortured to death on distant country roads, the fate, incidentally, under Mousavic of no less a person than the chief of police himself, Afshar Tus, and so on. This was the end of the sort of freedom that I experienced in Tehran in that winter of 1949-50. And never did I experience it again.
Yeah, but don't you think that this is what I was saying, that the Shah allowed things to go as far as they could go, and it was only when things got out of hand and the abuse of that freedom, as you say, that led him to believe that, well, obviously, it can't go on like this, now I'm going to do it my way.
Well, it must be remembered that from 1953 to 63, broadly speaking, for another 10 years, he endeavoured to rule with the Majlis. It was in 1961 that the Majlis was finally suspended and he began the White Revolution and to rule by decree. So from 1953 to 1961, he attempted some form of modified, shall we say, constitutional rule. And certainly in 1961, one could, in sympathy with him, take it that the experiment had failed and he was now going to try and rule himself. Though those were plenty of signs from 1954 onwards, I'm afraid, growing signs that he wasn't really in giving the Constitution a fair crack of the whip. There was plenty of signs, 55, 56, 57, 58, which were years when I was actually living in Tehran, when people were constantly complaining to me that it would be so much better if he ruled constitutionally, reigned constitutionally, rather than ruled as he was doing, assuming all the responsibility. As of course people used to say, Hadji Barmish Bishdarast, you see, I mean, he was widening his roof so that the weight of the snow, as it were, the snow weight of responsibility on it would be the greater. There was always this complaint, and there were people trying to advise him to go the other way, said Ziauddin Tabatabai being one of them. Others who advised him received very short shrift indeed. Ibrahim Haji Nuri never got made a senator again after his attempts to state to the Shah that Sultanat Kanto, to reign was better than to rule, and that sort of thing. He was hardening his position, and of course already from the time of the fall of Mossadegh onwards, with the suppression of communism and the operations of the SAVAK, as it eventually became, the security organization, his position deteriorated very considerably. This I blame the United States for. The McCarthy era in the United States was in fact transferred to the lands of United States allies, by which I mean bases, lands in which the United States, which the United States desired to strengthen against as fortresses, against the spread of Soviet power. And you got appalling persecutions and tortures.